Hello, everyone, and welcome to this next session in our series of distinguished speakers from the global corporate world. Today, we have Rich Lesser with us today, and we will have, I hope, a great discussion on a broad range of issues, including sustainability, DE&I, and really the global state of affairs. Rich is an incredible, renowned person in the world of consulting, the world of corporate affairs, served as CEO of BCG for a number of years. You spent 30 years, I believe, at BCG.
33.
You were voted top U.S. CEO by Glassdoor in 2021. That's quite an accomplishment. And not only are you one of the best CEOs in the country, you are also an advisor to CEOs, not just in the U.S., but all over the world. So I think you bring a unique double CEO perspective to this discussion today. We have a lot of things to talk about today. We'll be getting questions from the audience. But before we get into the specifics of sustainability and DE&I and other topics, would you mind just telling us your personal story? How did you go from kind of where you grew up to becoming the CEO of BCG?
Well, first, it's wonderful to be with all of you. It's great to be with Bridgewater. I have so much respect for this organization and how unique you've been in the world and driving a value creation agenda on many dimensions. I'm sure we'll get into various aspects of that. But I grew up in Pittsburgh. I was a chemical engineer. I made soap at Procter & Gamble, and I liked P&G and got bored of making soap. And I went back to business school in the late 80s. With the express goal of being in an environment where I wouldn't just learn one way of doing things, but I have a much broader exposure. And BCG just fit. I want to drive impact, and I like sort of solving the hardest problems. And that was BCG's reputation then, but frankly, still in many ways is true. And so I joined BCG, having no idea how many years I would be here. And thinking I'd work on a zillion different clients, and that was what I wanted to do. And as it turned out, it wasn't what I did. I ended up having many fewer client relationships, but much deeper, multi-year, really sort of supporting complex change agendas. And I found that my real joy came from actually driving impact. And the other thing I loved was building BCG, which was kind of a unique place. I mean, for context, BCG's grown about 14% a year for 30 years. Since 1990 through now, and over the last eight or so. So it's kind of it's just got a mentality of you look for what's next, you invest to get there, you build great teams, it's organically driven, we're an organic growth environment, we do a very small amount of M&A stuff. Anyway, so I evolved in my career, I changed industries multiple times from technology to industrial to consumer to biopharma. I took on internal roles, led recruiting in New York when we really needed to grow New York. We were way too small. Then led the New York office for 8 years, then led the Americas, then became our CEO. And when I became our CEO, to be perfectly candid, I had been so client and internally focused that I really had no presence in the world. I wasn't someone, I'd never been on TV. I'd never written one article in 20 some years. I mean, that wasn't my thing. But in the role of CEO, then I just ended up getting involved in a range of things. And, you know, and then over time, that's changed quite a lot. And then I finished my three terms. That's the maximum for my role. It's an elected role amongst our partners. And I went back to helping clients and contributing in other ways, mostly in climate and sustainability since last October when we made the transition. So, and I have three kids. They're all getting older now. And a wife I met at Harvard Business School, and we live just outside of New York, so probably not so far away from where you guys are. And so anyway, that's
an extraordinary a journey. And you would have seen so many parts of the world evolving and companies growing in to become great companies today. I know you say you didn't have much of a public voice when you became CEO. But at least looking at it from the outside, I think you personally have certainly grown to have a strong voice on many topics, including on sustainability. And BCG, in fact, seems to have been focused on sustainability for a number of years, actually for a long time. And I thought if we can begin this first part of the conversation and talk a bit about sustainability, Would you mind just open up by describing what your and BCG's journey on sustainability was? Like how, when did you get started? Why did you get started? And for you personally as a CEO, why was that such an important focus area for you?
So I'd be delighted. But I have to say with all honesty and humility that BCG's journey in sustainability preceded me, and until just the last 3 years ago, I would say really wasn't driven by me. It was driven by a set of passionate partners who cared about it. And I think part of my own journey that I really empathize with a lot of CEOs who didn't get into a CEO role to focus on this. They came in with, you know, other business building agendas or missions, and now it's on them. And what did they do? Because it wasn't something that I naturally just automatically arrived at. BCG started doing sustainability work in the late 2008, 2009, started by my predecessor, actually, who started it. And when I came into the role, it was a really good group of people. They were doing good work, but it was clear there wasn't so much client uptake. I mean, we did some work, but just it wasn't a huge agenda. And it really was, I never tried to discourage people from working on it, but it also wasn't like really high on my priority scheme. I was much more focused on digital and analytics and what was going on across the world and across our client base on that. I served three terms. When I was first elected to my third term in 2018, right after that, several of my partners were clearly pretty pissed off at me, to be direct. And because they thought we're doing something wrong, so that we weren't doing enough of what was right. And they started sharing with the whole partnership without asking my permission, which was probably a good thing, you know, videos about how the world was falling short off of the Paris Climate Accords, how desperate the situation was, how businesses weren't stepping up. And they weren't saying that BCG wasn't doing anything. Their argument was we're just not doing enough, that we're in this unique position of seeing the whole world, working across 50 countries, working across every sector of the economy, and we weren't stepping up to the full extent of our capability. And at first, when you're the CEO and you have people kind of telling the whole partnership what we're not doing enough of, it stings a little bit. But then, you know, you learn and you engage with them. And I realized they were right. Like, it was just that simple. The data was, I'm a data-driven guy, if ever there was one. And the data was pretty clear. And so in the fall of 2018, I stood up in front of the partners and I borrowed, I think from Paul Polman, a line, changed it slightly and said we were going to be about people, performance, and planet. I forget which order I put them in, but planet was, people and performance was nothing new for BCG. As I said, we've been growing forever and our focus on our people is, so there was nothing new in those first two. But the planet one at that level was new, and I didn't know how we would do it. When I said it, to be honest, I was an intent, but without a plan. And then we started a Center for Climate and Sustainability in 2019. At the very end of 18, we committed to be carbon neutral, which I learned later wasn't that much of a commitment. I mean, now when I understand what it means with what we commit today, it was a fraction. At the time, it seemed like a big deal with millions of dollars of cost. Now we're talking many tens of millions of dollars of cost, but at the time, it seemed like a lot. And then I went back to school. I mean, that like pretty much literally, like there's so much to understand here. The issues are so complex, the technologies are complex, the change agendas are complex. So I just found myself constantly talking to teams and learning. We got picked to be the exclusive consulting partner for COP26. And I remember the first day of 2020, like January 6th, 7th, when everybody just got back, just before COVID hit, I flew to London, I sat with our COP team, I said, okay, by the end of the year, I got to know what I'm talking about. Like, let's start with basic education. Like, how do I learn? And of course, COVID hit, and everybody got distracted, and for months, and I became the COVID lead for the business roundtable. So, for about 9 months, COVID took a huge chunk of my time, but I still tried to keep learning, and BCG was learning so fast. Our teams are now working around the world, and hundreds of people are joining. So this is growing rapidly. And then we made our net zero commitment in September of 2020. We got our SBTI approval in June of 21. As I said, we were the consulting partner for COP. The World Economic Forum asked me to be the chief advisor to the Alliance of CEO Climate Leaders, which is about over 100 really committed CEOs who've made big commitments. And so, and I feel like now I, I still don't know the depth. Like there's always someone who's more expert on one technology or something than I am. Right. But I now have a pretty good landscape, an understanding of what's going on.
So if I take you back to that moment in 2020, no, it was in 2018 when you stood in front of the partnership and you said people, performance and planet. I would imagine probably some people in the audience looked at you the way a lot of employees have looked at CEOs when they made some of these commitments and probably had a couple of questions on their mind. One was, is this just rhetorics? I mean, will this actually mean something? And maybe the ones who believe the intent had big questions around, well, how do we move that ambition into the core of what the business is? So, of course, I think every company has some easy first steps, second steps they can take. But in terms of really thinking through what it means for your core business model, and in your case, I would imagine, I think the toughest question I think they could have had is, you advise companies all over the world. Now, how are you going to integrate the notion of sustainability in that work? And I think most importantly, when companies come to you and ask, in a way, are in the situations you were in themselves, some CEO of some company with a tough sustainability challenge has made a similar statement like you did. What do you go in and tell them? How do you tell them to actually get started on this journey? What are the levers that you would recommend that they focus on?
Okay, so there's 3 points there. So let me do the first one is, the day I said it, my guess is 25% of the partners, disproportionately European, were like, finally, and is he serious or is this just, you know, CEO rhetoric? Probably 40 or 50% of the partners are like, yeah, we should do this. It's the right thing to do. They read, they see what's going on. I don't want to say it was a passion, whatever, but they got, and the remainder were probably really like of all the, like, they weren't saying they weren't opposed to us working in it, but you know, why does this should be such a priority? I think those percentages have shifted dramatically over time. But when you first start change agendas, particularly if they're pretty bold and ambitious, you don't necessarily have everyone with you at the start. I think second, it was critical to translate that for us into 3 dimensions. One is that we had to walk the walk ourselves. We had to up our own climate commitment seriously, because you can't walk in, particularly in a world like ours, to a client and tell them how you can help them be so much better on this, unless you can credibly say, like, and we, in our industry, we're in a different industry, have different requirements, but we're world class. And we've gone from, you know, just barely meeting a minimum threshold to having a really good net zero commitment to now being on the 200 CDPA list companies of all 10,000 plus companies that submit around the world. So we've continued up that ambition. Second, we felt we had to show that we were committed to society. This just wasn't about driving a new consulting platform for BCG. This was a societal commitment. And between COP, the WEF, SBTI, WBCSD, country level plans in South Africa and Germany and all sorts of places, I think we've really tried to put massive amount. It's now our single biggest of our societal and sustainability impact, you know, investments. It's probably the biggest one, that we still do a ton in health and education and economic development. It's such a huge topic. And then third, you have to build the capabilities to help clients when they come in and say, like, so what do we do? And I think that part, of course, it's a learning journey, but if I were to characterize it at the highest level, it's like 3 words: commit, act, engage. The first thing is to help them understand what commitments make sense, which means you truly have to understand their baseline. You have to understand, you have to build sort of the carbon abatement curve, which is, you know, picture like from the actual stuff that produces more profit, like switching to renewable energy can take out carbon, but can often be profitable because it's cheaper than whatever the local other energy sources are, all the way up to the technologies that don't exist today that are incredibly hundreds of dollars a ton to abate, if you could even do it at all. So you have to get grounded in the analytics, not just of themselves, but of their supply chain. You have to build that abatement curve. You have to help them understand against that backdrop, what can they commit to doing and by when? And you have to commit to transparency and measurement, because like everything else, you guys understand as well anyone, if people aren't measuring it and tracking it, it probably isn't really happening. And so you've got to do that. Then the second is how to mobilize for action. how to organize. It cuts across every discipline almost in the company. It cuts across the supply base. It requires a different kind of transformation offices to really make happen. And it requires real sense of resource prioritization, where you're going to find the money, how you're going to do it. And then the third, for most companies, there's an engagement part. Certainly engagement in their supply bases. For all but the most, interestingly, and we could talk more about it if you're interested, for all but the most upstream companies like steel, aluminum, cement, the vast majority of what's in their supply chain isn't their own operations. It's the carbon that comes from the stuff they buy that goes into the products they make. So if you simply say, I'm just going to worry about scope one and two and my operations, I'm going to be net zero. For most companies, you switch to renewable electricity, you do a few other things, you get, 60, 80% of it out. That's not enough. And so you have to engage within your supply chain. In many cases, you have to engage across your sector, because if everybody acts alone, it feels very risky. If you can align on some things together, you can de-risk it for everybody, and then people still make their own choices and their own progress. And then there's a critical engagement with government and a critical engagement across industry, which there's a range of different initiatives and ways to contribute. So I would say, first, you start by educating, and a lot as we work with CEOs who really understand this quite well, but we work a lot of CEOs who are just at the earliest part of their learning journeys, just like I was, 3 years ago, so I have a lot of empathy. But then it's just sort of, what should the commitments be? How do you actually drive action? What kinds of engagement are going to accelerate progress for you and for your broader ecosystem? And I think that's the pathway to work through.
So, you mentioned, I think for you, you really start focusing on this 3 years ago. I think if at least my impression from the investor side, when we look at companies around the world, it's as if 3-4 years ago, there really was like a step change. And I think in COVID for many companies really accelerated it. And at least when I speak to companies or I assess their plans, I think there's been quite a bit of progress. But very often I think there still is a strong general sense of skepticism in the general public around whether or not companies are actually moving on this. So I know it's a very a high level question, but if you think about the clients that you've worked with, or you just think about the various CEO settings you're in, like, what is your honest assessment of where kind of corporate America is on this on this journey? And you, even in these three, from the commitments to the acting to the engaging, like how, if you were to grade their the level of seriousness or earnestness in their work, like where would you fall, and would you agree more with the skeptics, or are you more on the optimistic side in terms of what corporate America is doing?
Well, look, you can't look at the data, like the results to date, and be anything but a little skeptical, right? There's just not enough that are showing a deep decline. And we just finished a survey, and it was self-reported. So you'd think that would self-report towards the optimistic side. And I think 89% of companies said they didn't feel like they were meeting the carbon goals they'd set for themselves 5 years ago. So when you have people self-reporting, that's the self-reporting. So then you sort of say, so I think there's reason for skepticism. But if you look at the level of corporate understanding first, not even going back 3 years, I would say really almost post the worst of COVID. The worst of COVID was sort of that March to July period. It was hard to take your mind off of anything else other than what was happening in COVID. But I would say, so the second half of 20 through 21, SBTI commitments over 5 or 6 years have been growing at 65% a year in terms of the company signing up. But that means the vast majority of the companies have SBTI commitments, and I would include us in this, that are like less than 2 years old. So I think that we're really at the stage where most companies have made commitments. They've been validated. I think SBTI genuinely tries to be pretty rigorous around how it validates. But that means they're at the very earliest stages of delivery. And so there's a long way to go. And my sense is many companies have signed up without totally knowing what they signed up. It seemed like the right thing to do. They read someone else in their industry did it. Why not do it? some parts of it are pretty easy. And normally the early years, if you just push on renewable power and some efficiency moves and all the rest, it's actually not that costly early on to meet a curve to be net zero by 2050 and to be down half by 2030. But you run out of runway fairly quickly without at least taking on reasonably hard things, not the most advanced technology stuff, reasonably hard. So I think we're seeing many companies right now saying, wow, I've signed up for this. The world is watching me. You know, I'm going to have to publicly report. And I know some of the journey, but I don't know all of the journey. And it's coming faster than I might have thought. So I will also be honest with you, with maybe the exception of Europe and Canada, you know, governments aren't really helping much in this journey.
Right.
I mean, you know, we don't have a price on carbon. And price, by the way, doesn't necessarily mean a carbon tax. And it doesn't mean a price on every aspect. You could push for cars through electric vehicle incentives and not tax gasoline higher than we do today. I'm not a big tax increase kind of person. And I'm not saying taxes are the only answer. But there are multiple ways with emissions trading schemes or other vehicles. We don't have that. We have not enough investment in advanced technology, which will be essential in the 30s and 40s, and will take a decade to develop. We don't have consistency on transparency and measures. That's in discussion at the SEC. We'll see what comes out and if it's actually the right balance of genuinely useful and not overly burdensome. Like right now, no one knows how it's going to net out. And, you know, so we have a long way to go, a long way. And the stakes are really high and it's coming at us faster than we realize.
You know, on that, if I think about various industries, I think there's some industries that give you hope that they are kind of on the steep part of the curve in terms of improvement. I think actually the auto sector is a fascinating one. If you just look at, even in the timeline you described, the kind of post of worst part of COVID, if you just look at what global auto companies have communicated to the street in terms of their net zero commitments, from kind of broad commitments to specific EV electrical vehicle targets by regions, to I think for some companies 3 times this year they have upped their ambition levels. They have given more specific capex, a green capex guidance. Really, it's incredible to see how much those plans have evolved. And if anything, you know, some might be concerned that the ambition levels are now so high that can the whole auto sector actually deliver it? But then you have other industries that I want to ask you about, the ones really the hard to abate industries, of course, oil and gas, cement, certain parts of transportation, industrial gases, like really the ones where most of the emissions are concentrated. And I guess I have 2 questions. One is like, how optimistic, you must have done a lot of work with those industries. Like, what's your sense of whether or not you think they will find a path? I guess that's one question. And I think there's a second one, which there's a big debate for investors right now around how should you invest in a net zero manner? And I think a core question there is these assets that are not sustainable today, but are on hopefully an improvement path. Like, what's your sense of investors' role in that journey? But let's start with the first one. What do you think for these hard to abate industries? What's your assessment of their journey?
I'm genuinely optimistic they're going to make a lot of progress. They will not make progress far enough or fast enough if we don't have some collaboration between the public and the private sector to set smart policy to accelerate it. Like on its own, this industrial transformation will take place. The challenge is, the science of this is, it's not enough that it eventually happened. It needs to happen incredibly fast. It is hard to transform something incredibly fast in defiance of the economics of the industry, which starts with the demand, demand side of the equation. So if we do nothing publicly to alter the demand side of the equation, it's not that in the end we won't see hydrogen grow up and technologies for hydrogen get much cheaper than they are today. It's not that we won't find carbon capture and storage for the parts of the fossil fuel industry we need. It's not that we won't accelerate solar and wind. All those things are going to happen. But we need to happen at an unprecedented rate for any industrial transformation, certainly post-World War II, but even the ones pre-World War II took place over many, many decades. That wasn't like a couple of years. And so my concern always is the speed. And I worry genuinely. I mean, it's we need a collaboration. It can't be the public sector alone. The whole economy is driven by private sector. Private sector has to step up, has to own it, has to prioritize it, has to realize it's important to their stakeholders, starting with their employees. So I'm not in any way absolving the private sector of responsibility, but to go at the speed we need, and we don't do anything to alter demand signals. We don't do anything to accelerate investment in the technologies that are always unaffordable. I mean, look how much DARPA's done over the decades to help us build technologies that at the beginning no one would have done. But once you get over a hurdle rate, then you can drive them down a cost curve. I really do worry about pace. I don't worry about the end outcome, but the end outcome is the world goes up 2.5 degrees, not 1.5 degree. That devastates a lot of communities. It destroys a lot of nature. It puts us being in vicious cycles around Greenland or parts of Antarctica that get into irreversible, or the Siberian permafrost that can get you into cycles that you can't turn back. So we're just, I didn't mean it, but we're playing with fire. I mean, that is what we're doing. And so that to me is the challenge. But I do think we're on the right path, and I do think we'll make progress. It's a speed game.
Let me transition a bit to some of the other, let's say, broader sustainability or ESG topics that I think is very relevant in today's environment. So we spoke a lot about climate change and the role that the private sector has there, and the important role of the decisions that CEOs have to take in this regard. I think there's a broader set of, call it ESG-related topics, that are very pertinent and very difficult today. Which have to do really when ethical or ESG considerations intersect with commercial decisions. Of course, the Russia's invasion of Ukraine was a clear example of that, where I think the global corporate world took a very strong stance in terms of saying, you know, there are non-financial considerations that drive the decision we make around our Russia exposure. And simply, we don't want it. Like, so it was really not a non-commercial decision for greater good. If you kind of now then look forward, so away from the Ukraine crisis, you can imagine lots of those questions coming up regarding various types of jurisdictions. Should you, a lot of asking around China and human rights there, and how should that intersect with commercial decisions. I mean, there's a whole litany of commercial decisions intersecting with these tough ethical ESG issues. How you must have faced a lot of them also yourself, of course, at BCG, in terms of client selection and who you should work with. Tell me about that dynamic, how you face that both as a CEO yourself and as an advisor to CEOs. How do you think companies can navigate that that world of commercial decisions and broader ethical ESG considerations of where it's legitimate to do business and with whom it's legitimate to do business with?
So first, it's incredibly hard. And when I say, quite honestly, having served over a fairly long period as CEO, what I saw changing in the complexity of the decisions facing CEOs grew dramatically in that period. And then even since the 6 months I'm not doing it anymore, in some ways it's gotten even harder with the scrutiny that goes up. So I really feel, on the other hand, by the way, I think being a CEO today is such a privilege, because unlike just a simple shareholder value lens, narrowly focused, often short-term focused, you're expected to have purpose and figure out how you make a difference in the world and engage with different communities and look at the interests of different stakeholders. So in many ways, I think being a CEO today is a more privileged and exciting role, but it is without any doubt, whether you believe that part or not, a more challenged role with these the kind of considerations you had. I think that from our end, you start with a sense of purpose and what you're there to do and why you exist, what you're expected to do in the world, and a set of philosophies that underground that. Sorry, did you say something, Karsten? I couldn't hear you. Were you trying to jump in?
No. I was just telling my son not to bring the dog into the room.
Ah, I get that totally. Okay, I've been there. I think that. You start with purpose and what you're trying to do, and then you have to make some really tough calls. You raise two different kinds of things. I think in terms of the places we serve, our belief is that a more integrated world is a good thing, that is a positive thing for the world. And we believe we can be a force for good, for advancing societies through our public sector work across a whole range of governance models, some more autocratic, some more democratic. But we believe we can make positive impact in those places. And we think we have a track record that shows we're able to do that. We believe that we have very clear boundaries on the kinds of work we do and don't do, and very clear approval processes to try to make hard calls to walk away, often from very large amounts of work, when we think it falls outside the boundary of the work that we want to do. And so we've refined that over time. Frankly, we probably tightened it some over time, because you learn and you see the world around you. So I think we're at a higher level of sort of how we do that than we were, say, in the early part of my tenure. But I think we do that. Then you get into these really complex questions about, like, say, we just did the energy transition topic. Like, what do you do in the fossil fuel space? Which companies do you work for? What kind of projects do you take on? And that is also a moving target. I'm sure there's work we would have done 3 years ago that we wouldn't do today. And I have a hypothesis that there'll be work we won't do 3 years from now that's work we're doing now. You just keep, partly because you learn, partly because the bar goes up, partly because the world's in a different place. Like, no one doubts what, not no one, there are activists who doubt, but most people who look at it deeply know we need fossil fuels for probably at least a couple decades to come. And to say that we don't, you risk sort of the energy price increases, the political and societal disruption that comes, the starvation that will come in other parts of the world when incomes aren't sufficient to meet sort of rising costs of food and energy. But I think what's important is not that what we chose to do or not do is the right thing for every other company. It's that each company, right, honestly look at its base of business, honestly look at the choices it's making, put the hard questions on the table, and put in some process to decide philosophically what aligns with their purpose and what doesn't. And then how will they operationalize that, so it's not just words on a page, but it becomes real? And that will be a different answer for each company. But I think that exercise in today's world is a mandatory exercise.
So, you know, in I see questions coming in, you know, relating to one of the big topics of the day here is China. And I think you mentioned the example of coal. Like, there's lots of areas at the fringe of your businesses where you can stop doing work and it won't have a big impact. But if you look at China, for most Western companies, China is either a very significant part of their of their demand, or and or a very big part of their supply chain. And of course, with the global move towards, or in certain quarters towards a decoupling of the worlds, that has deep, of course, political and economic ramifications for the world. How do you think, for all those industries that you've advised over the years, who are deeply integrated into a place like China, how do you think? Do you think that dynamic will shift in the coming years compared to what it has been? And like, how do you even see that movie play out? Just given how intertwined the economic systems are.
So first, like, you have to separate hopes and likelihoods, like. We want a more integrated world. I know that, you know, the rhetoric and the issues are so deeply entrenched right now on both sides, and it's concerning. But I think so. We want to be part of helping to create a strong global environment. We want to be a part of shaping integration. But we also have to recognize that we're a business. Our freedom to operate comes from society. We don't get to make all those choices, and we respect that. So we're trying to be respectful, whether it comes to data privacy issues that exist in all countries, in China, in Europe, increasingly in the US and places like that, in thinking about how we guard confidential information, and thinking about the special responsibilities when you work in the public sector to make sure that you're securing everything and you recognize the sensitivities in the geopolitics of today. I do think we're heading towards a direction of decoupling. I hope we don't get to a full decoupling. I mean, there may be some aspects around platform technologies or other things where it's already true to some degree, and it will likely increase. So I'm not trying to be naive and say that won't happen, but if it goes to 100%, we're really almost back to the world I grew up in, the in the 70s or early 80s with like an iron curtain. And that is not good for the world. It's not good for the wealth of people. It creates enormous risks of small problems becoming big escalations. I mean, lots of things. So we will respect wherever the world evolves and figure out how to work in it. But we're trying to do what we can to make it a more positive, more global environment. It's hard these days, I'm sure we all feel.
Just to bring it a bit back here to the United States, one other tough, I'm just throwing tough challenges at you.
And, sure. And I don't have perfect answers, nor does anybody else. We do the best we can. Sure. Go ahead.
So I have another tough one for you, which is we see that companies more and more are expected to speak out on social political issues, even if they're not directly linked to their own operations. And in doing so, they really have to step into these very polarized political landscape and topics, sometimes with employees, often with employees on both sides of the issue. We have, you know, even being silent sends a certain message. And we see, of course, we see it in Florida right now on LGBTQ rights, voting rights in Georgia. If there's a Supreme Court ruling coming up around Roe versus Wade, we will see that dynamic come up again. When you speak, both, how did you think about this yourself? And again, when you advise others, like, what are the principles that you apply to wrestle with the question of whether to say something, when to say something, and what to say?
So the whether to say something for us started with two topics where we were quite willing to speak boldly. One was climate and sustainability, where we've been quite clear. Sometimes that's in keeping with what many of our staff want to hear, but it can be fully in sync or a little out of sync with what's going on societally. And the other were DEI topics. We're on diversity and equity inclusion. We believe in it so deeply. It's core to our values. And we speak about those, and we've been quite clear. And as recently as a couple of weeks ago, the head of our North America business wrote a wonderful piece on LinkedIn about support for the LGBT community. I don't think she referred to the Florida legislation, but it was in response to something that had been posted in that regard. And so, like on DEI and climate, we speak pretty directly and clearly. And on most other topics, we haven't. I will admit, I was pretty clear on the election in January 6th and the concerns on it. And I think it was the only, well, I wasn't CEO anymore, I was global chair, but that wrote on the anniversary of January 6th online about how we can't forget what happened and the risk to our country in doing that. I'm sure that made some, I could look tell by my LinkedIn comments, many people liked it, some people didn't like it at all, stuff like that. But I will say, you know, we have the privilege of being a private company. We have the privilege of mostly focused on our own staff who live in urban centers and you know, in different things. And I feel for many CEOs, this is just such a hard issue. And now even commenting, you know, puts you at such risk of being, you know, really called out and punished and so forth. And I think, you know, what's happened in Florida will be thought about by many CEOs and boards of what you say and don't say. I do think companies' best roles is try to have influence, because many of them have very strong networks within political leaders before legislation happens, than to try to comment after legislation happens of what they like. You know, it's you're unlikely to change it anyway. Whatever group voted it in is unlikely to change it, and they're mainly going to be wanting to be defensive around it, and therefore, you know, directly go after people who criticized it. So I think we'll see more hesitancy for people to do after the fact sort of critiques of things, even when they feel strongly. And I think the touchstone, most controversial issues, where businesses have rarely spoken out in the past on topics like abortion rights or things like that, I think there'll be a reluctance to do that. I think it'll be very hard. I think the general philosophy that when CEOs ask me, because this is like, if you ask what's on CEOs' minds right now, I think almost number one is the overwhelming cacophony of things coming at them from different stakeholder communities, how passionately people feel about issues, the sense of you have to speak to be aligned to your values. That was Russia, Ukraine, that's a whole bunch of issues in this politically divided country. I think it's the hardest part for many CEOs right now to navigate, and climate and sustainability, of course. I think that it's really important to be strategic and thinking ahead of where the difficult issue is going to be. It's very hard to react in the moment. I think it's worth taking a breath. I think sometimes the people that have had the biggest issues are people who've tried to speak very quickly in reaction to people being upset with them and not taking a couple of days to think about it. I think it's critical to engage and not try to sort it out on your own. If you're in a public company, that means not just with your leadership team, but with your board, and make sure that you have your board on board with what you're doing and why. I think there's some elements like that that are absolutely critical right now to navigate these incredibly challenging times. And despite all those things I just said, that doesn't mean it's going to be easy. It's really tough.
And, you know, but I think one of the points you made here with respect to speaking out on D&I, I think first of all, I think it's the right thing to do. And I think in your case, it's also an area that you have, it feels very genuine, because I know it's an area that you have been both personally and as a company have been focused on for a long time, 15 year plus. I know you've been, I think very engaged on all aspects of diversity and inclusion, both kind of representation. I know you've done that for a while. I think you've done a lot of great work around really spotlighting on inclusion. And I thought, could you maybe take us through the both your personal journey and also kind of the company's journey on this topic to where you are today?
Yeah, so I think it's a 2-decade journey. I give credit for the CO2 before me who really got us going, my predecessor who put enormous work, and then me, and now Christoph who's come after me. So these kinds of things, picking a business like ours where it's an apprenticeship business, people grow up over years. You don't decide this is my initiative for the year and then 24 months later declare victory. You work at it for years and years and years. And some of what you work on is sort of the operational elements. Are we recruiting in a balanced way across the various diverse pools? The metrics, and you track results and you really look at the data and you try to do that. Setting up groups, you know, diverse communities so that people can feel like they can be their authentic selves. So you create communities that are supportive of each other. So you create mentorship and allyship for people outside those communities. I was an LGBT before it was LGBTQ+, like with the very beginning. Like I was an ally because we had a gay senior leader in BCG who really started our whole network. And he realized early on that it wasn't going to work if the only people who cared about that community were the people in that community. And so he recruited a couple of us to be allies, the head of New York and Chicago, who ended up being the CEO and head of people globally. So he picked the right 2 people to sort of be allies to that community 20 years ago. And we really put a lot of time into it. You do things like that, but then you put an enormous amount of effort also into all the elements that get in the way of people being their authentic selves, of people not feeling included in small ways, not just in big ways. The big ways are often easy to address. It's the small things that can make life harder, of creating an environment that everybody believes we're really looking for the best of them, to develop the best of them, not find the worst of them and call it out, which helps all members of the community, but particularly more diverse members who wonder if, you know, they're being seen for what they can truly bring. And you go at it in a very authentic way, meaning senior leaders are in the room, senior leaders are committed. It's not just passed down to the HR team or 3 or 4 levels down. And then you're honest about where you're coming up short, you know. And for us, to be honest, you know, until about 2 or 3 years ago, so slightly before George Floyd, we'd actually made enormous progress in our women and our pride community. But we were not making the progress in racial equity in the US that we needed to. And the guy who ran North America in my leadership team sort of took an honest look at the data, which was as much about retention as it was about recruitment, and said, we have to change. And then he started it actually a year before the George Floyd murder and all the stuff that happened in the US in 2020. But then that obviously sort of really energized our whole team to say, We have to really double down. We have to invest more. We have to be stronger in mentoring. We have to be much more transparent in our data and hold ourselves publicly accountable, as uncomfortable as that can feel. and doing that. And that was a really critical part of the journey. So last year we had our most diverse class ever of incoming people, you know, across ethnicity, across gender, you know, like we're really now mirroring the US in almost completely and beyond in some dimensions. And that's what we want to be, but it takes a lot.
And on that, just to, in a way, if I can just double click on that for a second. And again, you told me I could ask you whatever I wanted. So again, I just continue throwing tough questions at you. If I just stay on the representation, and in particular, in a way, the failure or you were below your own targets on representation. Why, like, what was the diagnosis of that? Why was that? Like, what was the thing that had gone wrong? Like, why did you not achieve your goals there? And anyway, what were the changes you made? You mentioned some around recruiting, but if the issue was around retention, what were the core issues, and how do you know that you are now on a better path for all those this new incoming class that you say is very diverse? What makes you confident, or what gives you hope that the outcomes will be different?
So I think that we underestimated, I think we were recruiting in ways that weren't doing as much outreach as early as we needed to bring people in. So it wasn't that we weren't committed. I was a recruiter. I told you, I started in recruiting in the 90s. I mean, I believed in this, you know, in the early 90s when I was doing that. But I think we tended to be not putting as much effort and as early enough effort into building diversity into our recruiting classes. I think we genuinely tried to create a positive environment for every employee. I mean, that's BCG spirit, but I don't think we created environments that acknowledged where people were coming from to the same degree. I don't think we acknowledged the challenges people were bringing into roles like this from the come, you know, with all the societal pressures and challenges. I don't think we taken mentorship as far as we needed to. I don't think our senior team owned wanting good outcomes. I think that was genuine. It wasn't insincere. But it's not just about wanting. It's about investing personal time as leaders to support. So now, you know, we have mentorship where MDPs are supporting, you know, I think our Black and Latino colleagues as mentors. MDPs are managing director and partners, are our most senior ranks of folks when they come into the organization. And investing to strengthen the community. We changed our development model. We used to start giving people reviews, you know, strengths, areas for development, scores and grades from when they first arrived. I mean, it's the way we thought you had to do it. Now the first 6 months, I forget the name of the room, but we focus on just giving people development feedback. There's no grades, there's no nothing. For 6 months, we want to learn where people are coming from. We want to meet them where they are. And we want to support them and help them get on a more confident, stronger journey. And then, of course, eventually we do have evaluation processes and all of us go through that. That's fine. But we change it. I mean, a more of a strength-based development, which, frankly, by the way, is good for everyone. Like, you start it because you know you're not doing as well with diverse populations who are higher at risk coming in of things not working out. But doing strength-based development is good for the whole community, right? And I think a lot, we had flexibility for women in place, but not nearly enough. And we've now made flexibility and the ability to shape your own path at BCG, shape it in terms of being able to work part-time more easily, take time off more easily, work in different career paths because BCG is so much broader now. We've taken that to a whole new level. At one level, you could say we did that because we needed to do better on gender diversity and we were losing women disproportionately because flexibility can really matter, particularly because women are more likely to be primary caregivers. But when you do that well, you help everyone. I mean, many men take advantage. In fact, women only feel good about taking advantage of if they see that men do it too. It may not be the exact same percentage, but it can't be that this is the woman's program or this is what we do for ethnic minorities or whatever. You do things for your whole community. You know that they may disproportionately help some portion of your community. And I think it allows you to create a genuine sense that we are about making it work for every single person here and allowing every single person to be their authentic selves, not to you know, have to act like someone they don't feel is true to themselves, which I think particularly, well, for women sometimes, for our LGBTQ plus communities, I mean, those things really matter a lot.
So I've been throwing a lot of tough questions at you, and I thought I would now give you the racket. You can now throw some balls at me or at Bridgewater. Like, you have followed Bridgewater for many years. You know who we are, you know our culture, you know the business we're in. on the themes that we've talked about today, both sustainability, but also D&I, what are your tough messages for us? What are the things that you think either Bridgewater specifically or the asset management space should be doing more of? Where should we step up our game? Like what are the things that if you were CEO for a day here, king for a day, or ruler for a day, what are the things that you would want us to focus on?
So I'll say four things, and I say it more from the standpoint of your industry than specifically Bridgewater, which I know a bit, but I don't want to overstate and be presumptuous. So I'll say, so one is there's a big push, particularly with these sort of ESG kind of funds, about saying what assets you'll own or not own in those funds. And I understand for an investor and for some subset of investors, it's very attractive to say, well, I own these kinds of stocks, but I don't own those kinds of stocks. But the truth of the matter is it's often the most challenged companies that are going to be the most consequential on whether we successfully decarbonize the world. Decarbonizing your portfolio is worth zero. Decarbonizing the world is worth everything. And so I'm not saying there aren't companies that don't warrant divestment, that they're so bad and they're unwilling to acknowledge it. Then let's all walk away and let's hope that that will force change in management and mission and so on. But I think there are many companies where the real issue is not whether to divest or not. It's how to engage with them. It's how to have a voice. It's the willingness to speak up at a shareholders meeting, or better yet, in a private session, because shareholder meetings, like, you know, aren't necessarily where people are listening the most. They're mostly trying to get through them. But you're in a position to have a lot of private conversations. And like your industry, I think, has an essential role that maybe divestment is a small part. To me, the big part is engaging more, and engaging with a high bar of expectation that you are not just going to look at the last 0.1% of profit margin in a month. You're going to look at things that go beyond that and that have a broader impact. So that would be message one. I think message two is, as a leader, which you clearly are, you need to model, you need to be role models in your industry, role models in terms of your own readiness to commit to the choices you'll make and how you invest, to your own internal efforts. But that's the easy part, right? It's renewable electricity. And so, I mean, do it, of course, but that's not the big thing. It's the choices you make about how you'll behave as an investor, and frankly, about the transparency that you will demonstrate in communicating, you know, the footprint of your investments. It's really hard to do. Every financial firm is struggling with that. I don't have an easy answer. It will take years to sort out. But the commitment for the intent to do it and then figure out exactly how is really important soon. That may take a few years to really work through exactly how to do it. But a transparency, I think third, the leaders in every segment have to work to bring the whole community along. What has scared me the most, my top three or four list, it's not the very top, but in my top three or four list, is that we will see a shift of the most challenged assets from public to private ownership. It will be too painful for public companies to own assets. And the easiest thing will be to divest them to private capital that is not subject to the same scrutiny, the same regulation, the same pressure. And again, you play on many sides of the investment world. So I know you probably do some of both, but how to make sure that you're working with your industry to really discourage that, to encourage everyone, whether public or private, to live to a set of standards. And then the fourth, and I guess this is a little Bridgewater specific, and therefore you all will have to judge if it's a fair comment or not. The external reputation of Bridgewater is it can be a pretty sharp place. It's built on a culture of very direct feedback, and people have to be brutally honest with each other in doing that. At least that's what I understood. That's a good quality in many ways, but we have to support each other too. And I would just say, make sure that you look in the mirror fairly to say, are we doing it? Because you won't build diversity. Each culture comes with biases and behaviors that sort of meet the bar and don't meet the bar and everything. Like, if we're going to build diverse communities in our operations, we have to create environments where people feel genuinely supported, where we look for the best in people, where we give people opportunities to develop and grow personally. And yes, where we're honest in the feedback we give, but we're also acknowledging that people come with their unique strengths, and the way they manifest those strengths may not necessarily be the exact norm of the culture that they're operating in. And the culture can learn by acknowledging and appreciating those strengths, not just trying to drive conformance to the traditional model of what strengths are. And whether any of that applies to Bridgewater or not, I don't know, but I think we all have to look in the mirror and make sure that we're really trying to do that. So those would be my...
That's an incredible way to end. I think that all deeply resonates with everyone here on the call. I think you hit it right on the nail. I just want to thank you. We're up on the hour here. That was an incredibly insightful hour to spend with you. Thank you so much. So many CEOs around the world have benefited from your counsel, and now we have also, so have we. So thank you so much, and I look forward to continuing the dialogue with you. Take care, everyone.